Well, as most everybody knows at this point, Tuesday I got other eye surgery I have to do, so next week I'm not going to be here, and Dick Todd is going to be filling in, and he has a powerful message about the future of this place, so I'm going to give him top billing there, and I expect you all to be here to cheer him on. So there you go. Of all the Gospels, the one that's just the nuts and bolts and tells you the facts, of course, is the oldest one, the Gospel of Mark. Mark is a guy who's interested in the history of things. And when you talk about really difficult topics, it's probably just as well to forgo all the embellishments and stick with the facts. The ultimate crisis in the earthly existence of Jesus Christ is actually a one-hour segment of time that we kind of always jump over between the Lord's Supper and trial and the crucifixion. It's really that one-hour segment in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's what actually this picture's about up here, see. And if you remember, after the Lord's Supper, he gets up from the table and he takes his disciples out with him to this place. Gethsemane actually means oil press, in case you're looking for some trivia for the day. It's a place where you press olives, you see, and you get the oil out of them. And there's this lush garden there. It's a nice, pleasant place. Perfect kind of place to go when you have some heavy thinking and heavy praying to do. And, Christ goes to that spot. And from where he was, you have to go across a little stream, the Kidron, and you show up in this place. And what did he do? He took 11 of the 12 disciples along with him. That's important, see, because Judas has already taken flight here. He's ready to go out and rally the troops to make sure that they show up at this place at the right time and he can betray them. So now there are 11 of them left, and they kind of get divided up into two groups. When they get to the entrance to the garden, what does Jesus say? He said, well, you 8 guys stay here and just sort of hold the fort, you know. And the 3 of you, you can come with me. And of course, the 3 are the same guys that have always been there for all the big events. You know, Peter, James, and John. They always are sort of the A team here among the disciples. Okay? And he tells them to come with him because he's going to go pray for a while. Okay? And as a consequence of that, he tells them to, you know, pray and to be somewhat vigilant, and wait for him. This is going to take about an hour, okay? Which is a remarkable little time considering, you know, what's about to take place. And what basically happens in this hour is that the, you know, most diabolical transaction in all of history is going to take place. Jesus has to sort out for himself if he is going to take and make this supreme sacrifice for all of the trouble that's in the world. See? And that's no small order, obviously. And in the account from Mark, it says that he went in and he prayed and he kind of came in and out 2 times. But that he was filled with a sense of anguish, and he was filled with a sense of, you know, contemplation, and so on and so forth. You know, this just isn't something that's a fait accompli. Ultimately, he knows he's going to do it, but what he has to do here ultimately is align himself to be perfectly obedient to the will of God. See, he has a choice not to do this. You have to understand that. That's the key function of this whole thing. If he didn't have a choice, it really wouldn't mean anything. He has a choice. So as a consequence of this, he has to wrestle with a lot of things. And the first thing he has to come to grips with is his own mortality, which is something everybody has to come to grips with. Okay? But you understand, here's a guy who fundamentally is part of God, so he's immortal. So this is truly a conundrum here. This is no small problem. Okay? Because he's going to have to be obedient unto death. He's going to have to literally die, and he has to trust God that on the other side of this, there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel. Okay. He's going a place where nobody's ever been before, and nobody's ever gone since. So that's the fundamental miracle of the Christian message right there. Okay. But we don't pay a lot of attention to this, because I think one of the reasons is it makes us very squeamish. It's some of those things that it's a very uncomfortable kind of place. Okay. The fellowship of the meal and all that, and do this in remember of me, that's kind of easy enough. Certainly the victory of Easter morn and the resurrection, well, that's cool. That means you won the day, so that makes us feel comfortable. But what takes place in between is really kind of tough. So there are these three guys, Peter, James, and John. Now you understand that these people have witnessed what other disciples haven't. They've been up to the Mount of Transfiguration. They've seen Moses and Elijah come back, and you know, both of them have been dead for, you know, one of them's been dead for 1,200 years. So, like, hello. So we have a sort of understanding that if anybody on the planet could get with the program and understand what the plan is here, these would be the guys who would make it happen. Now, of all the people on the planet, there are only three people here that Jesus trusts to take into the inner sanctum of this garden. Okay? And what happens? Well, they're asleep. Oh, my God. You know, at the most pivotal, fundamental moment in human history, these guys are asleep. He has to wake them up. The hour is here now when I'm about to be betrayed, you know, kind of like, hello, you might want to wake up and see the main event here in the story, see? All right. Now, when you look at this, the disquieting part of it is that it's so representative of life and human nature. See, this isn't a pleasant sermon. See, this is a story about three kinds of people. Indifferentists, we'll call those. People are sort of apathetic, unattached, unimpassioned, indifferent to just about anything that happens. Oblivious sometimes. That would be the eight guys who got to stay outside the gate, see. You don't expect much out of these people. But you have to understand, in this story, those people are entitled to the same benefits as the people who get inside the gate. Okay. And they have been followers for 3 years now of this person whom they have seen time and time and time again do the miraculous. A person who has had an unswervingly noble character in all the crises and all the opposition and all the turmoil and all the questions and all the I gotcha games that have gone on before, all the critical choices he's had to make, he never stumbled, never faltered, never wavered, always produced the goods for 3 years, see. And he still doesn't trust them to get through. Now, you have to understand, there are people in that group. One of them is Matthew. Well, my God, he wrote a gospel. Hello. But he didn't make it in there, see. Well, there's Andrew. That's Simon Peter's brother. He got Peter there, and he also brought the Gentiles to Jesus. Yeah, but he didn't make it inside the front gate, see. Jesus knows this ahead of time. Okay? So it's
really kind of a tough call here. Now, there are these three guys who get inside. Now, because they fell asleep, and because even after what? Jesus says, I'm about to be betrayed. He gives them the Last Supper. He tells them what to do in these symbols that he's holding up and to do them in perpetuity, because this is going to be an important moment, you understand? What happens? Well, they go to sleep. I have to call them pretensionists. These are people who are all filled with the pretense of what it is that they're supposed to be doing. See? They're pretenders. They're people who are summer saluters. They're people who really get going when the going gets tough. See? These are people who are just asleep at the switch. See? And then there's one guy. See, to his credit, he knows what his mission is. See, that's Judas. But he's not in either one of these groups. He's not even there. He's off someplace else. See? Judas is always stirring the pot. See? Judas is a guy who's an antagonist. Judas is a zealot. Judas is emblematic of all those people in this world, all those causes in this world, who like to swirl a vortex of activity and commotion and a sense of recognition around themselves because they have some sort of hidden agenda. They want what they want. Okay. Is Judas any worse a person than the other people? No. He really isn't. That's the real diabolical tragedy of this whole thing, see. And the other thing about him is, you know, he's the guy who is always on a mission to fulfill his purpose. That's why he did what he did. See, it's not that he dislikes Jesus. What he wants in this sort of hissy fit of nationalism and trying to get what he wants for his particular group of people, I mean, he's known that he's a zealot, that he's going to force this moment to a crisis. And when that happens, Jesus is going to fulfill his vision of what he thinks Jesus is supposed to do. That Jesus is going to be this heroic superhero Messiah that's going to lay waste to everything that's around him, and Judas is going to look like the big hero. I'm going to get what I want. See? Now, you know, he's representative of Pharisees. He's representative of subcultures of people in all kinds of religions who are always trying to distort facts and always trying to garner a whole lot of frenzy of activity and emotion around certain things in order to try to disguise the truth and get something they want. Hey. Now, I ask you this question. Did these three classes of people perish from the earth that night in Gethsemane? Rhetorical question. All right, so you end up with what? Well, if that was the Christian church on that night, when Jesus is arrested and taken off to be crucified, well then, that's pretty much the Christian church and the world as it still remains today. See? The crisis of Calvary hasn't gone away. And the crisis of Calvary is the human crisis. See? There are always going to be people who are indifferent. They're the maddening crowd. See? They're maddening because no matter what you do or say to them, you just can't quite ever get them interested enough to make a difference in just about anything. And then there are those who are always rah, 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 rah. See? The ones who get to be part of the inner sanctum. See? The ones who get to be part of the power structure. And then when it really gets time to have to make a commitment, you know, they just fold up their tent and disappear into the night. Okay. It'll all go away. I don't have to make any sacrifice for this. And then the thing that is the just, you know, ultimate paradox of all this is the one person you can always count on to be there is the troublemaker. The one who's always looking to get their own way. See? Now, why is this relevant? Well, first of all, here we have a rather unusual amalgam of spirits and intentions and a sense of a corporate body, and that's a marvelous and, you know, miraculous thing. So I'm not talking about this. But you can extrapolate this scenario, this crisis, into just about any aspect of life and the world. Okay? We clearly live in a world today that is filled with zealots. See? Zealots are people who have causes, most of which aren't really much embraced by the vast majority of people. But then again, the vast majority of people are who? The maddening crowd. And then, you see, zealots manage to walk into places and shoot people, stab people, blow themselves up. And they manage to walk into places and create chaos and havoc and disorder everywhere they go because they have an agenda. Now, God love them, to their credit, what you have to say about them is what they will do that other people won't do is get out there and hit the pavement and make it happen. Okay? Now, if there were some balance in this equation, well, there is in a way, see? You see it there in the Joseph story, you know, it's, what happens? Well, brothers, in a great case of sibling rivalry, are going to sell this guy into slavery. They're too scared to kill him. Remember I told you a couple of weeks ago, because they always think the blood of somebody you kill in ancient times comes back to haunt you. So they're just going to sell him off into slavery, and he'll be done with the guy, and then dad's favorite kid won't be here to get all the spoils out of everything all the time. So in that particular moment, the maddening crowd rises up to the occasion, right? See, we're going to get this job done. This is what we want. It's amazing how motivated we are by what we want, isn't it? So at any rate, but what happens out of that? Well, God says just exactly what I wanted to have happen. Because this guy is going to go off to Egypt and become a big shot. And you know what? You're all going to start starving to death, and you're going to have to go ask him for a favor. Oh. Gee. God has a strangest way of turning everything upside down all the time, see? Jesus goes into this garden, see? I don't have to make this choice to die. Yeah, I'm going to make it. It's because it's what I have to do, okay? And he emerges and he becomes the hero of all of history, see? In that moment, a person for the right reason, at the right time, in the right place, makes the right decision, steps up to the plate. And we're all the beneficiaries of it, see? Jesus is another example of out of a great tragedy, he has to die, everybody else lives. Wow, what a bargain. Okay. Now, you know, to the story I've just told you, there's only one fundamental, simple symbol. That's it. Must be 250 variations of it, different configurations, different embellishments on it, blah, 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 but that's it. It's basically a horizontal vertical stick nailed together. Okay? That's the thing that's representative of the story I just told you, the human story, and the salvation of the human race. That's all there is. Okay? Now, if you remember, if you were here a long time ago, I said to you a symbol is an interesting thing. It only has the amount of power you give to it. I mean, that's just a piece of brass. Somebody in a foundry cast it, and that was it. Polish it up, put some lacquer on it, sits up here, and we acknowledge that it's a symbol of our Lord and Savior. Okay? Inasmuch as that we celebrate what it represents, it comes to life. It has power. Okay? One of the great ironies of life is the only time the maddening crowd ever rises to the occasion is when there's a great tragedy. Sad. But it's true. Okay. The maddening crowd rises the occasion when somebody flies an airplane into a building and it comes down. Okay. I used to live in New Haven and ride a train into New York. After that happened, it was like riding in a hearse, because everybody from New Haven to Rye, New York, knew somebody who died. And you could sit in a train and nobody said a word. For weeks, it was just quiet. You could be in New York City and you wouldn't hear a horn blow. See? The maddening crowd was touched by that. See? There's a great power in that. There's a great hope in that, because it says that irrespective of how irresponsible they are most of the time, there is something wonderful, heroic, dynamic, and beautiful that's part of the human spirit. Something worth saving. Something worth dying for. See? And then it gets to the trivial. You know, we have this big movement that's kind of come to a head in the last week, see? How we don't like to revisit our past as Americans. Okay? The last time I said America wasn't perfect, somebody in a choir got up and walked out of here. Say, was I wrong? No. But at the same time, we don't like to hear that kind of stuff. Okay? We fought a civil war in this country. Okay? And people on both sides of it had a passion for what they believed in, and a lot of people died, see. Now, the Jewish people, who are the quintessential people on this planet to remember their history, did what with the Holocaust? Well, every blasted concentration camp that I know of that existed in World War II is still there today as a museum. Okay? You can't deny it happened. It doesn't necessarily represent something that's particularly wonderful or beautiful. It certainly doesn't represent the best in who and what we are. But if you can go there and not be touched by it, you probably need to go see a psychiatrist. Okay. You know, sometimes there are important reasons why you need to remember your faults. Okay. And if you don't remember the dark side of the story of Gethsemane, you don't understand the nature of the human race and why this man had to die. Okay. You know, I find it sort of ironic. We want to take down all these memorials to all these Confederate people. Okay. Evidently, if you live south of the Mason-Dixon line and you get shot, you don't bleed. I don't, you know, why is it so noble to be on one side of a cause and not on another, see? Why is it that clearly the cream of the crop of human beings in terms of the generals of the Civil War was Robert E. Lee? When he walked into Appomattox Courthouse, U.S. Grant stood up and shook his hand. See, he knew class when he saw it, but he happened to be on the wrong side of the argument. Well, he knew he was on the wrong side of the argument. See? But, you know, he thought he had some sort of duty. You realize something about the Civil War? It was really fought on two fronts. the Army of Tennessee against, you know, the Army of the Republic out in the West, and the Army of Northern Virginia against the same army at the Potomac. The South could never win the war, but it didn't need to win the war. All the South needed to do was make sure the North didn't win the war. Lincoln knew that. That's why he laid waste to it, to all the South, see, to prove a point. The point has been proven, see. Now, what's the world going to be like if 100 years from now people go to some place and say, I wonder why there are no memorials to the people who fought in the South in this war, in which a million people died? Well, is there not something, some message to be remembered there? What would happen if I said to you, well, you know, it's been a good run, but it also talks about a lot of things that are politically incorrect, a lot of things that look morally deficient, things that make us squirm about ourselves. Why don't we just take this thing out and stop feeling uncomfortable about it? See? Why don't we just take that aside? See, why is one person's life worth more than somebody else's life? What did I say to you at the beginning of this diatribe? These people got left at the gate, but they're entitled to the same benefit as the people who went in. And God knows the people who went in weren't any better than the people who stayed at the gate. See? George Santayana said, if you can't come to grips with your history, you're doomed to have to relive it. You know, political correctness and all this balderdash that goes with it, you know, is tantamount to throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There are lessons to be learned. The crisis of Gethsemane, see, can be any crisis that happens on any day. See? Why in the world would there anybody on this planet want to say that they're a Nazi? Well, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, a Nazi by any other name is still a Nazi, to paraphrase John Donne. So the fact of the matter is, you know, come to grips with the reality of it. We're the people who are the ultimate beneficiaries of history's ultimate gift. Somebody made a sacrifice. Lots of people made sacrifices. See? Christ didn't want to make the sacrifice. See? In the times of crisis, we can come together, but let's keep our eye on the prize. Just don't follow the maddening crowd or whatever's in vogue or whatever's politically correct or whatever this week seems to be the right thing to do to make all the problems of the world go away. That's what the world does all the time, and that's why it never changes. That's why it doesn't get any better. So, you have a choice. Either accept us for what we are, all the warts on us, and say we're most blessed because we're going to get a whole lot better than we deserve, and hope you can teach that to the people who come after us. Or you can take all the uncomfortable things out of life and just pretend everything's hunky-dory. And where's that going to leave us? Where would that have left us if Jesus had walked into that garden, you see, that night in the midst of crisis and said, you know, I just don't think this is worth it. And in a small way, everybody on this planet has to make that choice. Some things are just worth it. This is one of them. Eternal God, be with us in our thinking, in our decision making, in our hopes, in our fears, in our history, in our future. Be with us in all things, that we might take this journey in faith with a sense of dignity and purpose, and a sense of integrity. Help us to at least once in a while rise to the occasion. Help us to be independent in mind and thought. Help us to be able to take some risks. Help us to avoid what's popular. Help us to know that throughout all of history, there has always been a right and a wrong. And unless we learn from it, we'll never know the difference. So abide with us in this moment, fill us with your Spirit, direct us to the power and the beauty of your holiness, that we might be your children, do your will, perform your work, and be with you forevermore. Amen.